Okay, how's everyone doing? All right, I have to lean down here. Excellent, me too. I went to Everest Base Camp in 2013, and the day after we went to Base Camp on expedition, we woke up at 3 a.m. in the morning to hike up Kalapatar. Now, Kalapatar is a mountain. It's 18,500 or so feet above sea level. And Kalapatar gives you the very best views of Mount Everest. It's directly opposite. And the idea is that you get up there and for sunrise, you see the views of the highest point on the earth. And we started our trek at 3 a.m. and you could just see the silhouettes of the mountains, the starry sky. It was nice and clear. But as we started to go up the mountain, the clouds started to come in and the visibility started to get more and more dim. And the silhouettes of the mountains became a distant memory. At one point, our Sherpa, it's called Santosh, great guy, he did the whole trek in flip-flops. And he turned around and he said, if you want to see Mount Everest, you better start praying. And So we're in Lent today, at the moment, and we're looking towards the Champions League final of the Christian calendar, which is, of course, Easter Sunday, when Jesus rises from the grave. And to mark this, we've been going through the book of Matthew, which is one of the Gospels, and we're looking at some of the key events that build up to Jesus rising again, the most significant event in human history. So far in the Gospel of Matthew, it's been a relatively gentle ascent. You know, we've been ambling through his teaching, Jesus' parables, building key relationships. We've seen some miracles and some prophecies. But now we come to this steep incline at the end of the Gospel where we're about to get a full view of the glory of God. But there is an air of uncertainty as you read the Gospel of Matthew, where if we think about how the disciples are feeling, there's a lot to consider. They still seem unsure whether or not Jesus is going to overthrow the Roman Empire or not. There's kind of undertones that they still think he's this supreme leader who's going to bring vindication for the Jews. And there's a bit of uncertainty about what's actually going to happen next. It's starting to seem a bit cloudy. So, back to Kalapatar. As we approached the top and these incredible views, we weren't sure if we were going to see Mount Everest and whether or not our incredibly early start and our long trek was going to be a complete anticlimax. I can't help but think this is probably exactly the same as the disciples felt at this point in the story. We had to fundraise like £4,000. We had to get jabs. We had to plan routes, buy equipment, fly to Nepal. I suffered weeks of deli belly. We trekked for 2 weeks. We went from 1,600 meters above sea level to 5,500 meters above sea level. We had altitude sickness, very questionable food, all to see Mount Everest. And due to bad weather, it was looking like we were going to miss it. And as I said, it's basically the same as the disciples. These fishermen left their jobs. They left their families. Left their livelihoods. They followed Jesus for almost 3 years. They were oppressed. They were marginalized. They suffered. They walked and walked and walked and walked, all to see Jesus take his rightful place as the king and to overthrow the empire. But as they approached the peak, this moment, the clouds seemed to be coming in. He's not a military leader leading an uprising. And there are whispers that the Jewish leaders want him dead, that the Roman Empire don't like him at all. And maybe this whole thing isn't going to end so well after all. Now, this context explains a bit about how the disciples react to the story we're going to go through. So if you want to grab a Bible, you might want one. We're going to be flicking around. You can turn it on or you can grab it out of your bag or you can put your hand up and our wonderful team are going to bring it around. We have Farsi Bibles, Russian Bibles, Mandarin Bibles, and Spanish Bibles. So if you don't want an English Bible, you can grab a non-English Bible. If you are English, I advise you have an English one. That'd be easier to read. So whilst you're looking for Matthew chapter 26, if you want to speak to the person next to you and ask them, what is the best gift you've ever received? and why? The most treasured gift, the most valuable gift, and what makes it so valuable? So I wonder, would anyone like to share any gifts that anyone would like to shout out? Any really valuable? Yes, Mike.
My wife bought me my favorite band CD from 95 that isn't in print anymore.
Ah, a CD that's not in print. So what made it so valuable?
It's probably one of my favorite albums from that band.
Yeah. So it's sentimental, hard to get hold of, rare. Any other crazy gifts? Great treasured gifts? Valuable gifts? I heard car. Yeah. An old banger from the dead when you pass it to us. And what made it so valuable, such a treasured gift?
I could drive around.
Yeah. Yes. Independence. It meant a lot. Incredible. So we'll come on to that. But we're going to go into our reading. We're going to dive into it. So you'll notice if you just look at Matthew 26 in your Bible, you'll see that it's sandwiched in between two stories. The first of which, at the start of chapter 26, is a plot to kill Jesus, the Jewish leaders actually saying, let's kill this guy. And then after our story in verse 14, there's Judas finally admitting, I'm going to hand Jesus over. I'm going to betray Jesus. So we have this story about love in between these two stories about hate, like a love sandwich. And we're going to go into the middle, into the filling. I didn't get to read it, so I'm going to read it. Starting at verse 6. While Jesus was in Bethany, in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured out on his head as he was reclining at the table. When the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste? They asked. This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. Aware of this, Jesus said to them, why are you bothering this woman? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. So you may be thinking, hang on a minute, I've definitely heard this story before. I thought it was a lady who poured perfume on her feet and used her tears and her hair to wipe his feet. And you'd be, that's what I thought anyway, shows how much of the Bible I know. So there are actually separate stories of this, which was news to me. The story appears about an alabaster jar in all four Gospels. In Matthew and Mark's accounts, they're very similar. And in Luke's account, it's with the hair and the tears, and it's in Simon the Pharisee's house, and this is in Simon the leper's house. And in John's gospel, it is also the same story as in Matthew and Mark as well. So slightly different, but just to say that at the start, so you didn't get confused. So in Matthew's story, he just refers to her as the woman. And in John, it's Mary, but I'm going to refer to her as the woman because that's the story we're looking at. And I feel like I sound really rude when I say that. But I just thought I'd tell you that's why I'm doing it. So I love this story. And I don't know about you, but when I hear stories, especially ones where Jesus rebukes people, sometimes it's the disciples, sometimes it's the Pharisees, sometimes it's other people, I'm always just like, yes, Jesus, tell them, like, shut up, it's so good. And then after a while, you realize that the people that Jesus is rebuking is also the reader. And I'm like, oh, I'm the reader. Oh, maybe he's rebuking me at this point. Oh, and you have a real tail between the legs moment. And I had that when I read this story as well, because I think that the rebuke Jesus gives is one that today's culture needs to hear, especially within a church context. Because this is quite a jarring message, and it's actually quite difficult to reconcile when we have an earthly mindset, what's going on in this story. Because our world revolves around common sense economics. So what does that mean? It means that you can spend money on yourself. Work hard, play hard. If you work hard and you have a good job, then you can have nice things. Your money belongs to you and you can spend it or you can share it however you like. For example, I had a job, I got a promotion, and I went from a very bad graduate salary to an average adult salary. And I thought, I am going to go out and I'm going to buy a hot tub. So with my first paycheck, I bought a hot tub and I had the best summer ever. Loads of barbecues, hot tub, it was brilliant. It was good fun. I would recommend. And they're pretty affordable if you get like an inflatable. Anyway, people thought it was a bit weird, as some of you probably do. But ultimately, it was my money and I could spend it how I liked. And people were like, oh, you got a hot tub. That's weird, but that's cool. Fair enough. So you can spend money on yourself. Second thing, common sense economics. You can spend money on other people. Our common sense economics allows us to give money to others. We can be generous. But there are often ties to our generosity. You know, there's a big debate. Is it possible to be truly altruistic? Can I really give something without wanting something back or receiving something for myself? There's always this kind of exchange, this slight psychological contract. You know, I'll get the first round, but you should get me a drink later. Don't worry, I'll pay for dinner tonight, but you should probably buy me dinner another time. I'll lend you 20 quid now, but if I'm ever in a tight spot, I would expect the same. And so we spend money ourselves, we can give money to others, and also common sense economics, don't waste money. You know, there's a general consensus that we should generally try and buy things for what they're worth, and if there's an opportunity not to spend money and to get the same thing, you should take it. So I wouldn't say, oh, I found a brand new sofa. Oh, I found a brand new sofa on Facebook Marketplace. It was £200, but I thought I better get the real thing. So I went and spent 10 grand on the same sofa down at DFS for no apparent reason. It would just be largely frowned upon. So that's kind of the economics that we operate out of. But as we see in this story, Jesus shows us that we should operate out of extravagant love economics, that we should display radical, recklessly lavish acts of generosity and adoration, especially when Jesus is in the equation. And I think today's reading shows this. We don't have the scope to compute such a radical and frankly irresponsible use of resources when we have an earthly mindset. When we use the lens of what the world teaches us, what happens in the story is ridiculous. But it's a good job that Jesus has this lens and he's able to teach us about it. So if we go back into the word, let's have a look at what's happening in this story. So verse 6, while Jesus was in Bethany in the home of Simon the leper. Now I love the way that this story opens up straight away with the gospel. This is Jesus, a respected teacher, and he is having dinner with a leper. And it just sets the scene for what Jesus is doing. He comes and he sits with the least, the last, the lost, those who are rejected, those who are ostracized, and those who are cast out from society. And it just really sets the tone for what Jesus is all about. And I love it as well. He's not just visiting Simon the leper. It says in verse 7 at the end, yeah, he was reclining at the table. He's not just coming to visit, to pay his dues. I can imagine you hear about social visits from vicars and they give communion. And I think some of them are in and out before they can have too much of a conversation. But Jesus here, he takes his time. He's reclining. Culturally, that's what you would have done. But he's showing that he's at ease. And I think it's beautiful. So we learn from Mark's account of this story. So we're in Matthew. In Mark, it's the same story, that the very expensive perfume that it talks about here was worth about a year's wages. And in John's gospel, it says that it was worth about 300 denarii. So I was doing my research. What does that actually look like in today's money? Well, in the feeding of the 5,000, Philip says that it would cost about 200 denarii to feed everyone there. So looking at the standard UK price for a meal, Tesco meal deal, £3, I crunched some numbers and I have deduced that it would cost about £22,500 would be a year's wage is 300 denarii, which is flawless maths. And if you add in the London living wage, then it would be about 25 grand. So I have deduced that if you had that much money and you bought very expensive perfume, you would get this puppy, which is called number 5 grand X-Straight Baccarat Limited Edition for a mere RRP of £25,000 per bottle. I know. So I was obviously, to get this picture, I was searching expensive perfumes and now my Facebook adverts are all like 10 grand bottles of weird gold diamond encrusted stuff. There's one you can buy for £1 million. I know. Yeah. So it is thought that the alabaster jar in this verse would have been a family heirloom. And the woman seemingly comes out of nowhere. We don't know who she is, especially in Matthew's account. We don't know why she's there, but she produces this moment of beauty out of nothing. And it just doesn't fit with our economics. But I just want you to take a moment, put yourselves in the disciples' sandals, and think about what's going on. You're living hand to mouth. You're relying on hospitality as you travel and as you teach, you follow Jesus. You're using all the money that you receive to feed and to clothe and to support the poor. And you're going from town to town and it is tiring. You are tired, but you're being hosted by your new mate, Cy. He's doing a great job, put on a real spread. He's got a sweet pad. And he's made you some vegan ramen and you're enjoying it. Someone has just started a brilliant anecdote about when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. You're all laughing. And all of a sudden, some lady comes in, she busts in, and she pulls out her Chanel X-Straight Baraka Special Edition, £25,000 RRP, and she just opens it up and she just pours it on Jesus' head. And you're just thinking, like, what is going on? Where have you even come from? And I just think, hang on a second. Surely the disciples' reaction here is valid. Like, it's so valid. When the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste? They asked. This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. I mean, how many can relate with the disciples here? The passage says the disciples were indignant. Now, that means showing anger or annoyance at perceived unfair treatment. And the root word was interesting from the Latin in meaning un or not, and dignus meaning worthy, that this is an unworthy use of perfume that costs so much. And I think it's a pretty good description. She hasn't stewarded well. There's no logic to it. You could have bought 7,500 Tesco meal deals with that money. So there's a huge tension. And I wonder if we are ever too quick to judge others as they seek to serve Jesus, especially if they're seeking to serve him in a way that they feel is relevant or appropriate or something that they've heard from him. I've definitely done it. Yeah, I wouldn't have done it like that. Oh, like, it was good, but could have been a lot better. I like the heart, but they just didn't execute it very well, did they? A bit out of tune, that singer. Not tonight, Ruth. It was amazing tonight. So good. They didn't even provide tea and coffee. But the rebuke that Jesus gives today is... Oh, no, that's the wrong page. Sorry. So we have these indignant disciples and we have the woman who is scorned by embarrassment. here because she's been vulnerable. And there's this exchange. And then Jesus comes in. I've gone too far. So Jesus comes in and speaks into the situation, and his words are really simple and they're really powerful. He simply says, in rebuttal to our common sense economics, she has done a beautiful thing to me. She has done a beautiful thing to me. And Jesus here shows his extravagant love economics. And often we search for the why, don't we? You know, why have they spent all the money on that? Or why have they done it that way? Or the what could have been? You know, if only they did it this way, it would have been so much better. But Jesus shows us here that he is looking at the heart behind the action. So what I want to know, what's confusing me when I'm looking at this story and thinking what's happening here, I just want to know what happened before this scene in this picture plays out. Like, what has led Mary or this woman to do this? Why has she grabbed the alabaster jar off the shelf or in the family safe and taken it and poured it on Jesus' head? And I think three things are happening here. So I think the first thing is that she knows Jesus. She knows who Jesus is. She knows that he's the Son of God. And she has made this decision to anoint him with the alabaster jar because of that. And I think it's amazing. When we understand the identity of Jesus Christ, everything changes. And I don't know about you, but certainly in my life, and even in the last year, I've really tried to focus on that. And what does the identity of Jesus Christ really mean for me? And I think this woman shows it really well, that there is no gift too precious for him. And the second thing going on, I think that she knows of heavenly treasures. Such reckless generosity that she displays is surely rooted in an awareness of where her treasure is stored. You know, Jesus teaches time and time again of the dangers of loving money, and keeping it as an idol or something to replace God, which I think we can often be guilty of. But Matthew 6, Jesus teaches, do not store up treasures on earth, but store up treasures in heaven. And I think the woman saw that what she had in her hands and what she could freely give out was a true display of this. But I think that she got something of this concept of heavenly treasure, that we are here not just for the now, but for the not yet. And finally, the third thing that's going on, I think that she knows Jesus's voice. And as I said before, if we look at this story in John, then we know that this is Mary off of Mary and Martha. And you know that Mary was famous because she sat at the feet of Jesus and she listened. Chris was telling me in the Middle East, if you're a teacher, you would sit down and you would have all of your pupils would sit at your feet. And in that story, it says that Mary sat at the feet of Jesus, that she was in a posture of learning, a posture of listening, and that she would have been someone who was really listening to what Jesus was saying. And as we see when we read the gospel now, Jesus is constantly saying, I'm going to Jerusalem to die. And none of the disciples are listening, but it looks like Mary did. It's so weird that the men didn't hear it, but the lady did. It's very odd. Very odd. But another hypothesis that I have, if it's not Mary, maybe there's something that she's hearing God in a way that we might say we hear God. You know, she's doing something that is kind of out of the ordinary. I think that it had to be provoked in some way. And I think that her knowing the voice of God, whatever that did look like, was absolutely integral in the actions that followed. So this woman, she knows Jesus. She knows of her heavenly treasure. And she knows his voice. And what is the result? The result is that she is publicly honored by Jesus. Now, he calls out what she has done, and he says in verse 13, truly I tell you, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Now, that is a prophecy that Jesus made, which is true today. The language, the Bible has been written in over 150 languages. It's preached all across the world. And we're over 2,000 years after this event happened. J.C. Ryle, I like this quote. He says, Christ loves to honor those who honor him. And we haven't really got time to unpack the word honor and go into to what that looks like. But I think this, the acknowledging who Jesus is and acting accordingly, lavishly, operating out of extravagant love, is a way that you will earn the honor of Christ. So, question for you. Do you know Jesus? Do you know of your heavenly treasure? And do you listen and act in obedience? Do you know his voice? So this is what I want us to think about. How can we address these three things, and how will that affect the way that we operate and the things that we give and the economics that we kind of operate out of? So the next question then is, how do we honor Jesus? And if you look in your Bibles back at chapter 25, if you go back a page, and the last teaching before we see these series of stories is the sheep and the goats, which is an infamous passage where Jesus separates the sheep and the goats. And it's highly controversial in some areas. But if we look from verse 34, we'll pick it up there. So it says, the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father. Take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. And here's the good bit. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was ill and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. Then the righteous will answer, Lord, when did we see you like this? And he said, truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters, I've paraphrased here, of mine, you did for me. Jesus here is telling us how we can honor him, how we can display extravagant, countercultural love. So you may be wondering, what happened to me when we were climbing Kalapatar? So after the Sherpa's throwaway comment about prayer, I was, of course, this is my chance. I will pray, things will change, and everyone will become a Christian, revival will break out. So I was there, I was praying in my head, please God, move those clouds. And then the ending we all wanted, the clouds... the sun burst through the clouds, and there was a small clearing. Not that one. No, we've started again. Oh, here we go. You have to wait for it. The sun burst through the clouds. There was a small clearing. How are we doing? It's not loaded. Ah. You'll have to wait till next week to find out what happened. Okay, it wasn't a very good picture, but the sun burst through the clouds and there was a small clearing, and we had about 10 minutes when we were at the top of the mountain, and we went from not being able to see anything, and it was just in front of where Everest was. This clearing came out and we got that money shot. We got the picture. We got the 50 Leica profile, Instagram update. And then the clouds came back over and we went down the mountain. But in the same way, sandwiched between a plot to kill Jesus and Judas's plot to betray him, here we have a beautiful story that reveals something of the glory of God and the upside down kingdom values that Jesus holds. You know, this story encourages us to look beyond the imminent execution of Jesus and to focus on what he came to earth to show us, that we are made to love Jesus extravagantly, to dine with lepers and to glorify the king. So if the band want to make their way up, we're going to close soon. But I think there's so much in this story, and I think that Jesus uses this woman, and again in Luke 7, that when we are vulnerable and when we come and offer what we have to honor Jesus, that he will honor us, and that there is just this topsy-turvy, upside-down way of thinking about our resources and how to use them, which is really intriguing. So I wonder if you'd stand with me just as we prepare to sing. And to respond, I thought we could just spend a moment to listen to God, and I thought we could invite the Holy Spirit to come. So if you feel comfortable, I find it helps to close my eyes, to focus on the person of Jesus. I find it helps me to hold my hands out in a posture to receive. And as we quiet our hearts and listen to Jesus, why don't we just ask, God, what's my alabaster jar? What valuable gift or gifts do I have to give to Jesus, to pour out? How can I honor you, Jesus? I think we saw a good example. We saw Michael come and share some of his poetry. We've heard Keith praying, heard Bridget singing, Ruth singing. With that alabaster jar, are you willing to give it up in a moment? Are you ready to let this feeling of overwhelming love, when you see the person of Jesus, just pour out, as you just pour out this alabaster jar that you have, in a moment of extravagant love? Is it your time? Is it your money? Your invitations, your home, your emotion? Your strength, your skills, your honor, your worship. When we operate out of extravagant love, it requires vulnerability. And it requires giving what you have in your hands at that time. Just as we read with the widow who gives two small copper coins, Jesus says, out of her poverty, she's given everything. And as I said, it requires a moment. It's a momentary thing. Extravagant love is impossible to plan for. What's my alabaster jar? And how can I honor you? Jesus, would you reveal it to us now by your Holy Spirit? Speak to us. If you feel you have nothing to give, and Jesus says, just come as you are, and he'll show you what you have to give.